Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week at this time and in our archives, you can also find shows where we connect the dots between your personal health and our total health environment. Each week on Connect the Dots, we talk with different authors, experts, physicians, advocates, scientists, and ordinary citizens who represent different facets of the way our personal health is connected to our world. We talk about environmental issues, health issues, food issues, and the science and policies that create the larger context in which we experience well-being, health, and also illness. Today I have a very exciting guest for our show that I'm so thrilled to be talking with. I've been reading his absolutely amazing must-read book. Dan Fagan, our guest today in Connect the Dots, is an associate professor of journalism, and he's also the director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University. Professor Fagan is a former environmental writer at Newsday, and he's also has twice been the principal member of reporting teams that were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize, which will not surprise anyone reading his newly released book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. For those who already know about the environment, listeners, the name Tom's River may be familiar to you already. This book reveals is an in-depth analysis of what went on there. And if the name is new to you for its health and environmental lessons that it can teach us, you're going to learn a lot on today's show. Welcome, Dan Fagan. Thank you for being with our listeners and me today.
Thank you very much, Allison. It's nice to be with you.
This is really a masterful book, and it doesn't surprise me at all that you were, right so close to winning a Pulitzer Prize, and I hope you do it this time. This work certainly deserves it. Can you just give our listeners just a brief orientation to, you know, why Tom's River, which is a town in New Jersey, a region in New Jersey, is, among those who care about healthy environment, kind of a famous case, let's say.
Sure. Yeah, it is a famous case. And the reason is that, you know, all over the world we know that diseases come in patterns, and when we see sort of clumps of specific diseases in particular places or over particular time periods, we call them clusters. And we know those clusters exist. They've existed for as long as people have been tracking disease. But what's unusual about Tom's River is that someone actually did a sophisticated, expensive, full-blown epidemiological study to try to connect the dots, as you say in the name of your program. And in this case, they did. They found a relationship between environmental exposures and childhood cancer patterns in this town of Tom's River. And that happens to be a really hard thing to do and a really expensive thing to do and something that is rarely even undertaken for many reasons. But it happened here in Tom's River, and it's actually, there are really only two residential cancer clusters that have been reliably associated with environmental exposures. And the other one, of course, is Woburn, Massachusetts, which your listeners also, you know, may be familiar with that name, famous from the book and movie A Civil Action.
You know, one of the things that makes this history of what went on there so poignant, so worth telling, and it makes your in-depth tracing of and retelling in very dramatic and almost like a thriller suspense kind of, where you sit on the edge of your seat waiting to see what's going to happen next. But what you're really able to do, and do so superbly in this book, is trace the history, you know, all that goes into making a situation, an environmental context that is dangerous to health. Normally people, you know, cancer, for example, you know, creeps up. You know, people don't understand what caused it very well. You know, it seems to just kind of come on people overnight without any warning or antecedent or reason why it chose person, you know, X over person Y. And yet many of the things that we do experience, like cancer or other illnesses, are many years in the making. And the breadth of your book really shows, you know, all that kind of goes into creating, you know, a toxic environment where major health impacts can grow over time or develop and then really, you know, kind of hit and harm people. And it's rare to get that full vista that you capture in the book. So, you know, it's really an important read for that reason. You know, what is a cautionary, you know, first of all, explain to people a little bit what the background is. Like, why has Tom's River become, you know, sort of a famous case?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the reason it's famous is because eventually the studies were done and those conclusions were drawn. That you know, the studies are rarely done and the conclusions are rarely made. But in this case, they were. But I guess what you're asking is, you know, why Tom's River in the first place?
And that's right.
Yeah, and I guess the answer to that is that the chemical industry came to Tom's River starting in the 1950s. As it did to many towns, the chemical industry was born in the mid-19th century for, you know, and I trace how that happened and why and how the chemical industry grew, you know, in the early chapters of the book. And it's actually very relevant to the Tom's River story because the chemical industry originally was the synthetic dye industry. All of the big names in the chemical industry that we know now, including BASF, the biggest chemical company of them all, really began with aniline dyes. And that all began starting in the 1850s and 1860s in Switzerland and Germany and England. But what these folks found is that while these synthetic dyes were phenomenally successful, they were also quite dangerous and very poisonous to the environment and to human health. They were associated with cancer as early as the late reliably associated with cancer as early as the late 1800s, where people started talking about aniline tumors. And so everywhere that these companies went, there was controversy. There was controversy over polluted water sources, polluted rivers, polluted wells, polluted soil. And there was controversy over workers and neighbors to the factories saying that they were getting sick. And in the case of the companies that eventually came to Tom's River, they were first in Switzerland, and then they worked together in Cincinnati at a couple of factories called the Cincinnati Chemical Works, which again became very controversial due to pollution and also rampant illness among workers. So in the 1950s, these companies, principally SIBA, a company known as SIBA at the time, decided they really needed a new place to do their work and to make dyes and other synthetic chemicals. They wanted a place where they would have plenty of room, where there would be lots of trees around, and they wouldn't be bothered too much with prying eyes, where there would be lots of room for them to dump their own waste on their own property, where there would be a river nearby where they could get rid of their liquid waste. And they also wanted it to be conveniently located, you know, near a rail line, and so they could ship out their dyes and other products all over the country, all over the U.S. So they moved from Cincinnati to Tom's River, New Jersey, in the early 1950s. And Toms River was happy to have them. Toms River at the time, a little town on the New Jersey shore, situated about equidistant from New Jersey, from New York City and Philadelphia. There wasn't a lot going on in Toms River at the time. It was chicken farming was one of the principal industries, and people were thrilled to have what they perceived as a big factory coming to town and a job creator.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me very much in going through the history and the breadth of what the many decades of the evolution of what became a terrible cancer cluster, ultimately, and a proven one, as you trace in the book, is the naivete that, you know, was prevalent back in the 50s, and to a certain degree is still prevalent today, where, a sense that, well, chemicals must be okay, because somebody's looking out to assure that toxic exposures are not taking place. There's been a naivete about their byproducts, the waste that may come from a process. So, you know, while we might be happy to see, you know, anything from, you know, the attractive dye color on a tablecloth that might come from this product, or, you know, the gas, the natural gas that might come from fracking, for example, or things that come from, you know, the energy that might come from nuclear power, there are always the thing that we don't see, and it seems like in the 50s it was very naive. People were very, very even more naive about it, is the waste that's generated by these various industrial processes and what happens to that waste. And that
seems
like
right about that.
A big part of the story there in Toms River, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Dye, synthetic dyes in particular, you know, especially the kinds of dyes that were made in Toms River, especially initially, generated massive amounts of waste. In fact, far more waste than actual usable dye. So the company knew from the very beginning that how it was going to deal with its waste was absolutely crucial to its overall strategy, and that was an important reason why they came to Toms River. I mean, the soil in Toms River, the soil on the factory grounds, was like a sponge. It was sandy with a shallow aquifer, and it could absorb anything that the company threw out there. And throw it out they did, both liquid and water. Both liquid and solid waste. The idea was it was just like a perfect place. Just whatever you dump would just disappear, quote unquote.
But where is it going to?
Right.
That's the irony. In those days, one thought we could just dump anything anywhere, and somehow,
that's right.
What was supposed to absorb that in people's thinking of that time? The earth,
yeah.
I guess, you know?
Well, there was just sort of a willful ignorance on the part of many people, and on the part of some of the people who knew, they just simply didn't want to say because they had an economic stake in the system as it currently existed. Mm-hmm. And we should also point out that you know, we didn't know as much about how chemicals travel through groundwater as we know now. Still, I think it's pretty fair to say that with any reasonable amount of precaution, you know, this company should have known that its waste handling practices were grossly inadequate. Now, not everyone agrees with that, and I should say out of fairness that you know, there was a big civil trial in the late 1990s, the mid-1990s, over who was going to pay for the big cleanup of this massive chemical factory. And the judge ultimately ruled that SEBA's insurers would have to pay for the cleanup, not SEBA, because while SEBA's waste disposal practices were certainly not ideal, they were typical, the judge decided, and you know, appropriate given the state of the industry and the state of knowledge in the 1950s and 1960s. I think there's plenty to dispute about that, but that's what the judge decided, and so out of fairness, we really should point that out. But the bottom line is that, you know, whether or not they should have known, what they did led to massive amounts of pollution moving off of the factory grounds and into adjacent neighborhoods and into water wells, both private wells and public wells. And I should say, too, Allison, that it wasn't just this factory. The other big thing that happened, was happening in New Jersey at that time, is that most of the big chemical industry facilities in New Jersey, and New Jersey was a major, major chemical producer until the 1990s or until about the 1990s when these factories started moving to the south and then overseas to China and India. But, you know, most of the chemical plants in the Newark area and North Jersey, they had huge problems with waste, and they didn't have what Toms River had. They didn't have all this extra space. They didn't have a giant buffer zone. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is that truckers would take big loads of waste and just hit the highway and drive down south into the pine lands of central and southern New Jersey, and places like Toms River and surrounding areas, and they would just dump their waste, often just into open pits in the forest, wherever. And that happened in Toms River, too. The other absolutely egregious, really more egregious environmental site in some ways was an illegal dump site in the back of a chicken farm. Hmm. And a guy dug some pits. He wanted to make some money hauling Union Carbide waste, so he took a few thousand barrels. Many of those barrels were leaking. And he just dumped them in open pits that he dug. And Union Carbide, well, they just thought it wasn't their problem. So they never really took a look until the guy had been doing it for many months. And by then, the damage was done. And that other site, in addition to the chemical plant, also contaminated water wells. And also, we think, ultimately contributed to the childhood cancer issues in Toms River.
Let's talk about those. You know, what were the issues? So, you know, this practice begins, people look the other way, it goes on, it seeps, you know, dumping into I know not where becomes dumping into rivers, the ocean, the groundwater, and, you know, or the air, and then it ends up polluting the drinking water of families. What happened? What devolved from that in this case?
Well, what happened is that people started asking questions. People who worked at the chemical factory noticed that people seemed to be getting sick. They had heard about what had happened in Cincinnati, the previous place where these manufacturing processes were being carried out. They didn't like it. They wondered what was going on. These workers also lived in the community, and so people in the community started to wonder. People whose children got sick looked around and thought, gee, there's a number of people in my town who seem to be sick. There was one particular woman named Linda Gillick, who's a crucial part of this story. And starting in the 1980s, she started looking around and said, wow, there's a lot of kids, including her own son, Michael, who were either born with cancer or developed cancer at a very young age in this town. And she began making a little map. She would put pushpins where she saw there were cases. And she wasn't the only one. Other people in town started noticing. And they talked to their local representatives, and they talked to the state health department, and there were some sort of half-hearted efforts to figure out whether Toms River really had an unusual amount of childhood cancer, but not really any serious efforts. For one thing, the state cancer registry was in really bad shape back in those days, and it was really hard to know what was really going on. It's hard to know how do we determine what a lot of cancer is. And finally, starting in the early to mid-1990s, there was a nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she started noticing that a lot of kids from Toms River were going into the pediatric oncology ward at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And, you know, it was sort of a black humor within the ward. They would say, oh, another kid from Tom's River. And the doctors told her, well, you're probably imagining this. It's really nothing. Just, you know, don't worry about it. But it really bothered her. And she would talk to the nurses about it. And you know, of course, the nurses really bond with children in a way that doctors don't necessarily. The doctors are moving from case to case very quickly. But the nurses spend long hours with children and their families. And so these weren't just names on a chart to this nurse. They were important people in her life. And it really bothered her that there were so many. So she talked to her sister-in-law, who worked at the Environmental Protection Agency, still does. Mm-hmm. And then that person knew the right person to talk to. And so finally, around 1994, 1995, the state of New York undertook a pretty good statistical analysis to see whether there really was a childhood cancer cluster in Tom's River. And sure enough, they determined that there was.
Wow.
But, you know, the state didn't want to release that information, and so things got complicated.
We're coming up upon a station break in a minute here, so I just wanted to, you know, kind of take a pause here and discuss that, because we'll continue the conversation on the other half of our station break. What's really kind of amazing to me is, and I want to talk more about this at the other end of the break, but, you know, parents noticing, a mom noticing, a worker noticing, nurses noticing, you know, we're kind of accustomed to dismissing that as, oh, that's just observational, you know, that's just someone's observation, that's subjective, that's this. That's not science. But in fact, it's the first observations that lead to science. And that's, but if we're lucky, they lead to science, or they're in the beginning of scientific research. So let's talk more about that in the second half of the show. Stay with us, listeners, on Connect the Dots. I'm talking today with Dan Fagan, the author of this wonderful new book, Tom's River. And we'll be back after the break. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. This is the second half of our show today with Dan Fagan, the author of the new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a town in New Jersey that became known as a famous cancer cluster case due to industrial dumping and contamination, and how the community and the citizens of that community traced the environmental damage and poor waste handling to illness created in their town, and really finally got the scientific proof for it. It's a very exciting book, and that's what we're discussing. If you missed the first half of the show, please go into our archives at Connect the Dots and give a listen and stay with us now. So, Dan Fagan, on the first half of the show, we ended talking a little bit about how it was really human beings, like kind of, I mean, they're not really whistleblowers necessarily because they're not really working in industry, but they're just kind of observant and caring parents or citizens who are the first to notice things that other people don't notice and pay attention even when, you know, it's just anecdotal, it's just, you know, it may not mean anything. You know, they're noticing the things that maybe, or maybe they're closer to the things, as you pointed out, with the nurses in Philadelphia's hospital system who were noticing many children coming with illness and cancer from Tom's River. They're the first to kind of sound the call and notice things that other people don't notice. I'd love to hear your comments about how that fits into the whole spectrum of science from your perspective as, you know, a leading journalist on the science of environment and health and how to report on them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that you've made. And, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do in this book is not only just to tell the story of Tom's River, which is quite a dramatic and important story in its own right, but to put it into the context of this much bigger story, this many thousand-year-old effort to try to understand the relationship between environmental conditions, including pollution, and human health, especially chronic disease, and the most befuddling of all chronic disease, cancers. And what I learned in the course of my research, I guess I already knew it, but it showed up again and again, is that most of what we know about cancer epidemiology, about cancer patterns, about cancer causation, really arose from somebody looking around and saying, huh, this just doesn't seem right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the oldest stories in medicine. You know, of the attentive physician saying, gee, why are so many chimney sweeps in London getting scrotal cancer? You know, why are so many metal workers, why are so many people who work with mirrors in Venice getting sick? You know, throughout history, we have seen this over and over again, and that is that people seeing what they perceive to be a pattern, and then trying to figure out what does that pattern mean. Now, of course, patterns can sometimes be deceptive. It's absolutely a fact that sometimes people think that they see a cluster, and it actually isn't a cluster. That you know, cancer, if we lump all cancers together, well, you could look, cancer is actually a fairly common disease if we put all cancers together. Which is problematic to do medically because each type of cancer is actually its own disease. But the point is that sometimes what looks like a cluster isn't a cluster. Sometimes what looks like a cluster is actually just luck, very bad luck, that sometimes things clump together for nothing but random reasons. But other times when people see a pattern, There may actually be an explanation for it, and that's how science begins. Observation isn't the end, but it's an absolutely essential beginning. And it really bothers me when people say, well, that's just anecdotal. No, it is anecdotal. That's not inherently a bad thing, but that's the starting point. And from there, then the science can take over. But to say something is just anecdotal and therefore it's not worth looking into, I reject that completely, and it really bothers me when, you know, whether it's a citizen activist or whoever is just sort of dismissed as a hysteric because he or she, it's often she, women tend to be much more observant than men about these things, you know, are just routinely dismissed. No, they shouldn't be dismissed. Observations are not the end of the process, but they're an absolutely essential beginning of the process.
Why do you think that happens? I mean, what is the context for that? I mean, I've heard the statement as well many times. And is it just too inconvenient? Is it, like, for example, if just as a, you know, pie in the sky, what if kind of thing, if community members who were disturbed by some of the dumping or waste management practices in the book, you recount that the company built a pipeline to dump a lot of waste through a nearby beach in an area of many beachside communities into the ocean, and mm-hmm. people at the time were protesting. If those people had earlier won the day, for example, the ongoing pollution that resulted in the cluster might have been, you know, lessened if the waste had been handled differently. But, you know, so also when people's initial concerns are characterized as anecdotal, it's a way to avoid handling the matter differently. What is the reason that companies, as in this instance, are not prepared to handle it in a way that is non-harmful? I mean, what would that have meant for them?
Of course, there are lots of reasons, and some of them quite obvious, some of them not. You know, it's true, of course, ultimately it's the people who are generating the waste that have the strongest incentive to do that is to get rid of that waste as cheaply as possible, whether that's dumping, and that's usually to dump it, you know, nearby. That's usually the cheapest option, to dump it or burn it. And so their incentives are obvious. The real question is, what about government? That's why we have government, to protect public mm-hmm. health. Why won't government step in and take a look, try to figure out what's really happening? And, you know, of course, there are lots of reasons for that. One of the clearest is that governments don't like to take risks. They don't like ambiguity. They don't like it when people are riled up. I don't so much blame the government agencies for this as I do the elected officials. You know, most government officials I know are actually work hard and their hearts are in the right place. They want to do a good job. But governments are inherently conservative by nature. And the reason is that elected officials, you know, are mostly focused on getting reelected. I'm sorry if that sounds cynical, but it's a fact. So basically, they want to keep things calm. And the more investigating you do, the more digging you do, the more sort of poking around and trying to figure out, okay, what's really going on here? What are the real consequences of you know, the waste dumping in this particular place? Then the more riled up people get, the more press comes, the more attention comes, and the more uncertain it is for the elected officials who ultimately run the government. So I don't so much blame the companies. The companies are just doing what companies do in a capitalist system, which is they want to maximize their profits to the extent that they can under the law. The real blame, you know, goes to government, I think, that it's government's job to make sure that companies are that the public health is protected. Mm-hmm. And in Toms River, that just did not happen for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to back up on that and challenge you a step further on the companies, if I may. Because one of the things that you say in the book, which I found very telling, was that to do the waste management properly, better, as they moved, as you recount in the book, from Switzerland to Ohio and then to Toms River, in order to handle it in a manner that was more protective of human health and the environment, would have cost so much money that it would have, according to their concern, and I don't know who crunched the numbers or if this is just a general fear, but it would have made the activity unprofitable and resulted in the closing of the company. At least that's sort of hinted at in the book. I don't know if that's
at various points, the company would make that argument, you know.
Right.
Okay, well, you want us to close the waste pipeline, then we're going to have to close the factory.
Was that an empty threat, or is it really that their profit margin depends upon dumping stuff, you know, for other people to handle?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to answer in a hypothetical, but it's the kind of thing that companies say all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, you know, listen, this is capitalism, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the system that we have. And, you know, under our system, the idea is to create a set of rules that all companies, public and private, have to, profit and nonprofit alike, you know, have to adhere to. And it's our job in a democracy, and then the elected officials who we elect and the government that we create, to make sure that those rules are enforced and written properly and enforced. You can't really expect a chemical company to go beyond what is required under the law. They're not going to do that. And if they can find a cheaper way to do it that's still legal, they're going to choose that cheaper way. That's what happens under capitalism.
So it's the legal loophole that has to be closed.
Well, sure.
By government, actually, is what you're saying.
I'm saying that it's government's role to protect the public health, and if there's something happening that's not protecting the public health, then the rules need to be changed. But, you know, a company is not going to do that on its own. You know, we need to be proactive citizens, and we need to have a proactive, aggressive government that actually cares about protecting health and the environment. you know, companies are just they're just rational actors. They're going to do what they need to do to stay in business while also complying with the law, we hope. And, you know, often, ultimately, of course, Allison, what that means is that when conditions change in a place like Toms River and environmental rules get much tougher and labor costs go up, companies leave. They look for cheaper places to go. And that's what I'm really concerned about now is, and we all should be concerned about, is that, you know, many of the practices that would never happen today in a place like Toms River, certainly mm-hmm. not after everything the town has been through,
mm-hmm.
you know, may be happening in places like Alabama or India or Central China.
Mm-hmm.
We know they're happening in Central China, inland mm-hmm. China. You know, that's the cycle that, to me, is really most disturbing of all. Just as if they, you know, things began in Europe and eventually moved to America, and now they're moving again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they're always kind of off in search of virgin territory in terms of the land and naive territory in terms
yeah.
of the governance or the population
yeah.
to sort of continue these activities. You know, and the threat is also, you know, the threat that the factory may be shut down. It's kind of like there's this tacit threat that civilization, you know, with all of its conveniences, may be shut down by changes in energy policy or changes in environmental policy, you know, and the implied threat is that the costs of civilization, at least in a profit-centered capitalist society, as you say, is paying this human price. I mean,
right.
and that without that, that's, you know, we wouldn't be able to source and manage and supply the needs of civilization. I mean, that's the kind of sort of hidden threat there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's, sometimes it's not even hidden. Sometimes they're quite explicit about it.
And
the problem is that the quote-unquote benefits that we see from these processes, you know, shiny paint and strong yet flexible plastics and abundant natural gas, so, you know, all the things that we've come to enjoy in this society, those are all readily apparent in the short run. We can see them right away, and the profits that are generated from those products are also readily apparent in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
The costs, however, are much more latent.
Mm-hmm.
We often don't see them for a long time for many reasons. You know, when it comes to environmental damage, it's often hidden or hard to determine. And when it comes to the human cost, you know, the cost in human health, especially for, you know, we're not talking about, you know, like acute poisoning where things are quite obvious. It occurs immediately after someone drinks highly contaminated water. That's one thing. But for a chronic disease like cancer, where latency can be 7 years, 10 years longer between first exposure and disease, takes a lot longer, and it's also, of course, incredibly difficult, you know, again, to connect the dots scientifically, in part because of that long period of exposure, long period between exposure and disease. So it's really not a level playing field here. We see the benefits, but we don't see the costs, and often when we finally do see the costs, it's too late. And that's really why I wrote this book, because I want people to understand. I would love to see all of us be more proactive about thinking about the consequences of what we do. I mean, that doesn't mean rejecting every piece of technology, not by a long shot. It doesn't mean that anything synthetic is bad for you. But what it does mean is that we need to be smart, and we need to be aggressive, involved citizens, and ask questions, and ask. We need to demand more of our government than we do right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a time where, you know, government is a dirty word almost, and the public health is a core responsibility of government, and we're just really not doing the job now. We have amazing technology that we apply toward the for the so-called war on terror. Well, where's our war for human health and the environment? I mean, I don't see it, and I hope that this book will in some way spur that on.
Well, you know, I believe it will, and I also just, you know, have to say I'm very enthusiastic about what you're saying, which the regular listeners to my program won't be surprised by that statement, because we share very similar outlooks and values, and, you know, in looking at the same issues, really, because, you know, what you're covering is also what I look at, although in different areas. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, okay, in the case of Toms River, we have a very, you know, relatively clear-cut, long-term case of chemical waste dumping, you know, traveling into water supplies, influencing the health, creating a cancer cluster, you know, with those specific chemicals. For the average citizen, you know, who is not living in that targeted or specific and hard to prove, as you show in the book, scientifically because of statistical models and other features, you know, who's not living in a specific cancer cluster, we nevertheless have, you know, cancer almost as a normal phenomenon, a normal stage of human life for so, so many people, for such a large portion of the population, and a wide range of different kinds of toxic outputs, you know, which then become inputs into us, you know, from various different sources. And there, in that case, you can't even, you know, point to a single locale with a single factory in a single cluster, but you have, like, kind of a rising level of multiple toxins. How good a job does our science do, and does our government do in understanding, on the one hand, and protecting us, on the other hand, from that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and you know, my own sense of somebody who's written about this for a very long time and read a lot about it and spoken to a lot of people and tried to stay on top of the research is that we're not doing enough, you know, not by a long shot. If you ask me, you know, are environmental conditions generally better now than they were 20 or 30 years ago? I would say yes, they are better. If you ask me, are people living longer and healthier lives, I would say it depends on who you're talking about. But, you know, we don't have to be hyperbolic about this. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's no doubt in my mind that the regulatory process as it exists right now is not balanced. It is not as science-driven as it should be. It's too politicized, and it's too dominated by the manufacturers. And the reason that it is because science is expensive, especially modern science. Toxicology is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. Doing a rat study to try to find out whether a particular compound is carcinogenic or not in rats, you know, can cost several million dollars and take 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Government doesn't do that. You know, people think that our system is that government does the testing. That's not the case. Testing is overwhelmingly done by manufacturers or their contractors, and then the government simply reviews the data. That's not good enough, in my opinion. And you know what I've learned, and over the course of my career as an environmental journalist who writes about these things, is that science can always be spun, and whoever does the science has the ultimate power in this society. Mm-hmm. And the people who do the science, overwhelmingly, when it comes to toxic chemicals, the people who do the science overwhelmingly are the manufacturers or the contract labs that they hire. And that's a problem. That's a real problem. And I think it's why our system is not as protective as it should be. I mean, we ought to be really heavy into what's known as green chemistry, which is finding safer alternatives for existing products, existing ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that, not nearly enough. Why? Because we're wasting all of our time fighting about the most toxic chemicals that manufacturers are managing to keep on the market as long as possible, instead of looking for safer alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, it's really hard to blame the manufacturers for that. They're just doing what companies do. It's really the role of government to represent us and to find a middle way and to say, okay, we don't have perfect information about this compound, but what we see is not good. We're concerned about it, and we think there's a better alternative. So, manufacturer, we want you to switch. We want you to use something safer. That doesn't happen nearly enough under our regulatory system. And I got to say that Europe, for example, is really doing much better than we are. They're far from perfect, but they're moving toward a more proactive system for regulating toxic chemicals. They're taking hormone-disrupting chemicals much more seriously than we are here in the United States, than our regulatory agencies are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that we can do much better than we are.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as the role of journalism in this?
Well, I think journalists have an absolutely critical role. Anytime you have a subject that is complicated and nuanced and requires some expertise, it's really hard for the public to grasp it. Not because the public isn't bright. They're very bright. You give them the information and you explain it clearly, they'll get it. The last thing we should be doing is withholding information from the public. But journalists are really essential, I think. Good journalists are essential as the middlemen and middlewomen in translating what's really going on in a way that the public can understand and act on. And, you know, that's why journalism education is so incredibly important to me. It's my career. In addition to being a journalist, I'm a professor at NYU training future science journalists. And we need good science journalism now more than ever. We need evidence-based journalism, and we need fearless journalism that is unafraid to go wherever the evidence leads us, even if it makes some people look bad. But we've got a problem, you know, and that is that the rise of the Internet has made it much more difficult to sustain a lot of professional journalism. And we're really confronting this problem and doing the best that we can. But it's not easy at a time when we need really great science and environmental journalism more than ever. The economic models of science and environmental journalism are under incredible pressure, and it's very disturbing.
This is really true. In fact, we're having as an upcoming guest on the show Robert McChesney, who has been tracking.
Very bright man.
Yeah, he's terrific. He's been, and we've had him on before with his previous book that he wrote with John Nichols, where he talks about the decline of American journalism and the changes in the business model, exactly what you're speaking to there. And he has a new book about where the Internet is actually driving us in terms of as an economic model. And that's coming out shortly, and he's going to return to the show to discuss that, because all of these different things kind of intersect. It's kind of a, you know, there's kind of a natural cycle where, you know, it's our job as journalists to kind of provide that information so that citizens can then become proactive with government, so government
yeah.
can, you know, it's like there's actually a natural cycle here.
Yeah,
and,
there really is, and
yeah.
and on these issues, it's just so important. It's just so incredibly clear that now more than ever, especially on these controversial, complex topics, we need journalists who know what they're talking about and who have the time and inclination to really go digging. We need that now more than ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, also, you mentioned digging, because also, I mean, this is something that I find in my own reporting, because I report on Huffington Post and Alternet and other places too. But there's actually, with the internet, it's kind of like having, you know, a huge library where you can call and aggregate and sort of source a lot of information, but it isn't the same as the kind of support, and, you know, so that one can sort of do virtually, you know, from anywhere, but it isn't the same as going into the field, which really takes, you know, the support of, you know, publishing institutions, really, to go out, as you did in this wonderful book, and, you know, meet the people and see the places, and that's also what gives, beyond the, you know, the kind of culling of the scientific research, that's really what gives people who read your book, Tom's River, the, you know, the kind of hearts, the sort of human interest and kind of identification and caring about the topic. And I think that's such a essential element in conveying this information successfully, as you do in this book. And I just want to also give one more, probably one more, but not the last, plug for your book, Tom's River. It's coming out imminently, A Story of Science and Salvation. It's actually by a publisher with whom I've worked in the past, Bantam. It's a really terrific book and a terrific read for anyone who cares about the issues that we're talking about with today's guest, Dan Fagan. You know, so if you could sort of wave a magic wand, and, you know, what would you like to see to, because really the end point that we're talking about here is public health, really. The environment is not, I mean, it's not just about, I like to go hiking, you know, I love to bird watch. It's really, the environment is really the source of our health. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because I think that sometimes we, in our society, have come to think that we ourselves are the source of our health.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, it's really helpful to take some biology, you know, in high school or college, or some environmental science, because you realize that you know, we may be the top predator, we're the dominant species, you know, we're shaping the world in a way that no species ever has before, but the world is also shaping us, and it's, there's a kind of a hubris sometimes among many people who think that, you know, we sort of operate independently of our environment, and that's not the way it works at all. The environment can be a source of you know, incredible, you know, sustenance. We can't survive without it. But the environment can also be a source of hazard, especially often when we ourselves have somehow damaged it, and it's really, really important to try to sort of step back and think and look holistically, you know, at the whole system, which is something that we rarely do as humans. Again, it's like a kind of a short-term, long-term problem that I was explaining before about the so-called benefits versus the costs of some synthetic chemical manufacturer. You know, the benefits are obvious, the costs are less so, and that's really true in our relationship with the environment too. The environment is not just, you know, some sort of a mystical place that we go for spiritual renewal. We go just because we want to stretch our legs. You know, the environment is us. We have a huge impact on the environment, and the environment has a huge impact on us and on our health. And we have to really be mindful of that. We have to think holistically, and we rarely do. There are plenty of people who try, but as a society, we're definitely not there yet.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard, isn't it, too? Especially even, you know, like writing about science and looking about science, you know, on the one hand we have the need, the very real need and the demand to nail specific points of evidence and data interpretations together in order to kind of constitute a science scientific view of reality. But on the other hand, those exact minute detailed data points don't actually help until they're all connected, which is why the show is called Connect the Dots. But until they're all connected, they don't really, that view doesn't really help us to perceive holistically, does it?
Yeah,
that much.
You're right. You're right. And, you know, so often people are just focused on what's right in front of them. And
right.
And again, that's another crucial function of journalism, to sort of step back and look for relationships and put things together. Just as the citizen activists in Toms River, you know, looked beyond their own families and tried to figure out relationships that might be happening, broader relationships in their community and its environment. And that's what we all have to do, and that is a really, you know, again, I think it's a real core function of journalism, and it ought to be a core function of government, too, and we ought to be demanding that of our government.
Thank you so much, Dan Fagan, author of Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. It's been a total pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much, Allison. It's been fun.
I wish you all luck with the book. I hope maybe you'll come back again. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Tune in next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.